Lecture 16, Descartes, Rousseau, and Kant.
In the last lecture, we were considering the fortunes of natural law theory here upon American shores. In this 16th lecture, I'd like to return to Europe and return to somewhat more technical philosophy, precisely in order to investigate for just a bit the fortunes of natural law within the tradition of philosophy, more formally speaking, because there is much in the history of modern European philosophy that casts doubt upon the entire project of natural law in any of its forms, whether in the form of the Stoics or the form of Thomas Aquinas or the form of Locke that found establishment and institutionalization here in the American Republic. In the European philosophy of the early modern period, there are various trends which are antithetical to the whole project of natural law. In particular, the mechanization of the world picture. We saw earlier on in our study of natural law that one of the most important concepts was the notion of teleology, or end-directedness, an inbuilt end within our nature, something that we didn't decide upon, but that was already there and that was the pattern for our development and was a natural goal for the individual and the family and whole culture. But the mechanization of the world picture, that is, that tendency in modern science and modern technology to reduce all kinds of causes to efficient causality, to the way in which human agency is able to structure and restructure things, drives out the notion of final causality or end-directedness, and that is antithetical to any form of natural law. I'd like to discuss in the course of this lecture some of the philosophers who are very prominent in that tradition of mechanization, and then the ethical implications of it. I'll begin with a short discussion about Descartes and the change that happens in modern philosophy, and then for a greater length of time, I'd like to focus on Rousseau and on Immanuel Kant, who were extremely influential for thinking about ethics and about human freedom and about political organization, and who do so in ways that change natural law, certainly, perhaps make it impossible, or if they make it possible at all, make it possible only under a very, very different rubric. Let's begin, however, with Descartes. As we were saying, the notion that was typical of causality in, say, Aristotelian philosophy or in much of the realist philosophy of the Middle Ages was a notion of causality that was differentiated. There are the internal causes of matter and form, that is, the structure and the stuff that makes up anything whatsoever in the universe. Anything has a certain basic matter, and it has a certain form that that matter has. These aren't two things, but rather they're co-principles, structure and stuff. In addition, causality refers to the agent, the efficient cause, the person or the object, which is imposing a new structure on stuff. And then finally, and most importantly for natural law theory, there's the notion of final causality, the sense of a goal or a purpose. It's something that's so obvious within, say, human artistry and human invention. When we have our purposes, we have our goals. The claim of Aristotelian philosophy is that in addition to our imposed goals or our imposed purposes, there are also natural goals or natural purposes, the things that one can see when, for instance, acorns only grow up into oak trees and never into dandelions or pear trees, or the fact that tadpoles always grow up into frogs and never into any other kind of creature. So too, it was argued, the human being from the time of conception through the time of natural growth has, as at least one natural goal, developing into the complete adult mature human. Things can go wrong, diseases can interfere, there can be actions by other human beings, but that these effects upon our natural programming are extraneous and that there is at least a natural end that should be provided. Some figures would be quite willing to say that there's an end that transcends our life in this world, a supernatural happiness, but that even if one is confined to this world, there's a sort of a natural happiness for which we are well designed. In the course of modern European philosophy, one finds all of this brought into doubt by the mechanization of the world picture. Mechanics and the mechanization of science means the elimination of final causality, a sense that what we explain when we explain something in natural science is explaining its mechanics, its matter, form, and efficient cause, and that we rid ourselves of the notion of final causality. The philosopher who I think is best representative of that tradition is René Descartes, in many ways the founder of modern philosophy, and one finds that very quickly in Descartes all of the Baroque scholasticism that we were discussing with those, especially the Dominican thinkers who had opposed slavery of the Indians on the basis of natural law, that all of this Baroque scholasticism is gone precisely because he so compartmentalizes the theoretical sphere and the practical sphere. The theoretical sphere now has to be handled in these instrumental and mechanical terms. The practical sphere will be what we decide upon, not what we in any way find as rooted in nature. In the course of doing so, there's a great division between all of ethics and all the rest of philosophy, and if you divide ethics from the rest of philosophy, you can no longer use nature, which is a category of metaphysics, in your ethics. So what for Descartes and the rest of the tradition of modern philosophy, this strong separation is invoked, and it will mean that if we're going to have any objectivity, any universality, any intelligibility, those three strong characteristics of any ethical theory, if we're going to have intelligibility, universality, and objectivity, we're going to have to get them from a different source other than nature. One of the thinkers who I think follows up the ideas of Descartes and wants to find a new way to establish objectivity and universality is the figure Jean-Jacques Rousseau, figure of the 18th century. He is very strongly opposed to natural law in any form of a deductive system. He wants no part of the notion of deducing natural law obligations, or for that matter, natural rights, either from the historical state of how things have come to be or from some primeval state of nature. Rather, he is very, very strongly interested in the course of his works on talking about human autonomy and human freedom. So he will still use the categories of human nature, but it can't be used to found a system on any natural law. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is a very difficult figure, I think, to understand, primarily because so many of his works involve constantly a retelling of his biography, except that every time he retells the biography, one finds it's a slightly different biography, and we've practically got a new individual. But in his most prominent political work, where one sees some elements of that biography combined with a lot of interesting philosophizing, in his book The Social Contract, he deliberately and thematically attacks the notion that it is possible by reason, the thing that was so useful for all of the natural law thinking we've been considering, it was impossible for reason to learn the principles of natural law by reflecting on the state of nature or by reflecting on the law of nations, what is common to the law of so many different cultures, or what is found in a given constitution trying to analyze human nature and what anthropology requires. In fact, there's even a strong suspicion against civilization as corruptive and corrosive. He attacks all the intellectual traditions that are in natural law. He attacks Roman theorists as well as some modern figures whom he considered to be unfairly and inappropriately representing those Roman theories. By name, he attacks Grotius and Hobbes, whom we considered about three lectures ago. And in particular, what he's suspicious about in them is their justifications of slavery. So one finds oneself torn, agreeing with Rousseau because slavery is so inimical to what human nature demands, and yet also finding him attacking the claim that by an intellectual pattern, that by an intellectual process, one can reason to this conclusion. Well, you say, if he doesn't think that reason can get us to natural law, how does he think we should get there? One finds in a book like Emile from 1762 that Rousseau argues that the real way to get to it is by our feelings. He suggests in Emile that the Vicar of Savoy is a good standard for this. And at one point he has the Vicar of Savoy praising, quote, "the inner light of conscience, whose judgments are not judgments, excuse me, whose commands are not judgments, but feelings." Likewise, in Rousseau's book, The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, that complaint about civil society and civilization as he knew it, it's a 1754 volume, Rousseau very openly defends an emotive view of morality, that it requires that we stress human feeling, sometimes human sympathy with other humans, or at least our sense of a feeling of what we feel is right about a situation, what we feel is wrong. Technically speaking, in philosophy, this is an intuitionist approach. It's a sense we may not be able to provide the reasons which will convince anybody else, but for ourselves, the ultimate basis for our assertions, the basis for our confidence, is our intuition about a situation. Hence, it's emotivist because it's dependent upon feeling, and the justification is intuitionist. Either you see it or you don't. Now, Rousseau does treat human nature, and so he's still the philosopher. You can take, I suppose, the philosopher out of philosophy, but you can't take philosophy out of him. And he does treat human nature, considering topics like true feelings of the heart, pity, and altruism. And he urges that these true feelings, these reliable feelings, can be a useful guide for learning the fundamental principles of morality and the fundamental principles of politics. He doesn't think that reason can do this, and he again stresses his opposition to an intellectual theory of natural law, but he strongly advocates that our better and nobler feelings, feelings such as the primitive might have, the noble savage, the true innocent who has yet been uncorrupted by civilization, that these true primitive, original, noble, savage-like feelings can help us discover our true nature as free individuals living according to laws that we impose upon ourselves. Now there you see, I think, the real clarion call of Enlightenment thinking, a sense that what are we primarily? We are primarily free individuals who have to trust something in ourselves, that which is deepest in us, our feelings, and that when we create something in a social contract, when we create a set of laws, we had better do it in ways that are somehow fundamentally conforming with these deepest and truest and noblest part of ourselves. Hence, his theory will be something we'll try to cultivate freedom as much as possible, and yet acknowledge the fact that sometimes we must make these social contracts, corrosive as they can tend to be, if they can provide us some of the benefits and some of the advantages that we so desire. Curiously, in Rousseau's writings, especially in his book Social Contract, but also in that discourse on the origin of inequality, he uses some of the very same language that John Locke and Samuel Pufendorf had employed, the state of nature, for instance, or the very term social contract. But he uses those terms for vastly different purpose. The chief emotions of someone in the state of nature, for Rousseau, are pity and self-love. And these, he thinks, flow from a spontaneous natural goodness. One sees this coming up frequently enough in our own contemporary discourse from some ethical quarters who want to suggest the things that are most basic to us ethically are our feelings. One sees, I think, in Rousseau a fundamental root of this notion that there's a spontaneous natural goodness. If only we would let it emerge, a trust that that will occur. One sees, of course, how very vastly different this is from that long Christian tradition that we had been examining a few lectures ago, a sense of original sin, a sense of the defects of our natures, a sense of the way in which there's still a basic goodness, yes, but that too much of our problem is precisely that our loves get badly ordered. And hence, this is the thing which is not, in principle, recoverable, except with the aid of grace. Rousseau would insist, this is the very thing that needs to be recovered, and the one thing that is trustworthy. Virtually all of Rousseau's writings are about education, in one way or another, programs of education. And in this way, I think he resembles Plato than almost all the other modern philosophers. But in the course of writing about education, what it is that I think that he emphasizes is that we need education in social relationships in such a way that these spontaneous natural goodness can emerge, that we need habituations of spontaneity. It's a curious paradox, but we need to find ways in which people can be themselves, then it will all work out. Civilizations, however, are something to be feared. They can corrupt individuals as much as they can improve them. And so much of Rousseau's literary energies go into proposing specific ways that we can try to retain all the advantages that government and culture bring us while rooting out some of those evils that have come in the course of history, inequality, self-deception, and exploitation. In short, I think Rousseau is trying to cultivate the sort of life that is possible in society and at the same time maximize the original freedom of the state of nature prior to society and prior to the introduction of government. It's a desire to have the advantages without the cost. One can see why he wants to do this, and I can't complain about that. But the preferred way for doing this, the preferred way for reducing the tensions between all of those constraints which life in civil society require of us and the natural freedom that was ours in the state of nature and that he would like to recover, for him, the way to do this is the social contract. Again, I point out the way in which this is now changing for very deliberate purpose. This is changing the understanding of a society or of a government. It's a way in which I think many modern people understand the matter, as Rousseau does, that society and government come about and have a legitimacy only because of human convention and human invention. Whereas an older theory, in the natural law theory that we have been studying most of this course, viewed even government and society as having a nature. And they could say that, admitting that the particular forms that government or society take will be matters in which human creativity and human intelligence have intervened, and yet they intervene to produce some forms of government and some forms of society which will be more helpful in administering natural justice and natural need. For Rousseau, I think there is a sense that social contract is precisely that. It is a contract and as such a human invention. Rousseau envisions the social contract as the surrender that everyone makes to the general will, quote-unquote, by which impartial laws for the common good will be made by the participation in everyone in a directly democratic process. That is, I think he's suspicious of representatives and representative government, and he hopes that this will somehow freely apply to everyone. Of course, doing such on a grand scale, anything beyond a small city, quickly proves to be impossible. There is, however, one point of connection here in this part of Rousseau's theory with traditional natural law theory, namely the conviction that Rousseau clearly has that individuals who will the general good unselfishly, that is, as somehow part of the general will looking for the common good, will produce a natural harmony. And in that respect, I think he's calling upon the Stoic tradition, who had always insisted that there are things one must do if one expects there to be a harmony of the whole of society. As such, I think Rousseau can call upon that Stoic tradition that just as in the order of the universe that the Stoics had championed, so too for Rousseau, submission to the general will can bring about a natural harmony. What he most hopes, however, to come from this situation is natural freedom. As much as possible, the restoration of the kind of freedom that we had in the state of nature. And for Rousseau, in all of his books, this is at the very center of his ethics. For him, both moral and legal obligation can only be understood if an individual gives free and uncoerced assent to the principles which are going to apply to everyone as matters of law. Hence, it's a strong emphasis upon the consent of the governed as the main condition for the legitimacy of a government. Now, when one turns and asks, well, what effect did all this have? Who bought Rousseau's ideas? And I think the person who is most indebted to them in the history of philosophy and whom we need to consider now for the last portion of this lecture is the great figure of Immanuel Kant. There in Kant we see someone who accepts Rousseau's commitment to freedom and autonomy as the purpose of ethics. There is someone who accepted Descartes' separation between nature and practice, a sense that what we can perhaps understand in the realm of natural science and philosophy will always be of the phenomenal order. It's something which comes about through space and time and can be processed through the various filtering systems that our own bodies and the forms of our sense organs and then the very categories of our mind make possible. But all of the things which can be known to science and to philosophy will be things of the phenomenal order, whereas things like God or freedom are never phenomenal. That is, they are never things which are in space and time. They are rather things which transcend space and time, and hence are, if not supernatural, at least transphenomenal. As such, the realm of the practical order, the realm of ethics, the realm of politics, cannot have a basis in nature. It will have to have a basis in reason. Now, as we step back and before we look at the details of Kant, that is, to accept natural law tradition in a way and to reject natural law tradition in a way. What I have been trying to emphasize about the non-negotiable core of natural law ethics is that it's a matter of reason reflecting on nature. But notice there are two parts. There's a nature to be reflected upon, but it's also our reason doing the reflecting and trying to discover the natural order, the natural end-directedness, and what it is that will most accommodate the accomplishment of that end. Both of them are non-negotiable, reason and nature. What we find in Kant as the heir of Descartes, and especially as the heir of Rousseau and his cultivation of freedom as the very central value, what we find in Kant is a strong sense of the commitment of ethics, the dependence of ethics upon reason. Reason has to establish principles. He's distrustful, I think, of Rousseau's natural, spontaneous human goodness, but he wants the value that Rousseau most emphasized, natural freedom, and he thinks that the way to get it is by the cultivation of pure reason. The central concept that Kant will use in his ethics is the concept of the categorical imperative. This is an effort to try to find a way to state ethics in terms of law or command or imperative, and yet to do so and to by stressing the rational source of this categorical imperative. As such, we will see the tremendous difference between Kantian and the ancient and classical and medieval views of philosophy in which nature and ethics were not so separated. What does Kant propose? Well, in particular, he proposes that moral theory cannot be rooted in a special notion of human nature as theoretically known, but rather must be rooted on reason reflecting upon our pattern of choices. That we have to avoid considering merely the ends of our choices. That would be utilitarianism, to which Kant was strongly opposed, and instead focus on that which is most basic about our reason, namely our ability to understand the implications of the choices that we make, especially as pertaining to the maximizing or the minimizing of the freedom that is so essential to practical reasoning. Rather than link the goal of ethics, the goal of human life, to any specific end which is external to us, rather, one wants to link the goal of human life to the cultivation of our freedom, to maximizing our choice and doing it in a way that will always seem to be reasonable. In the course of doing so, Kant proposes this interesting theory of the categorical imperative. And it's an imperative. It's a notion of a command or a directive. It's a source of obligation. And yet he thinks that the categorical imperative will be the precise way of grounding our ethics in a way that does maximize our freedom. It operates basically in this way, namely, that whatever one feels that one wants to do, one should make a general rule out of it and say, here's something I would like to do. If I'm going to have permission to do this, I must give permission to everybody to do this. If, on the other hand, what I'm considering is something I wouldn't like done to me, I've got to make a general rule that forbids it and include myself within the scope of that general rule. Now, as such, we have an advertence here to a notion I think that is familiar to us from biblical morality. One remembers it in the form of the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, or perhaps in the silver rule, don't do unto others as you'd rather not have them do unto you. Notice how different this is from the Wall Street version, do unto others before they do unto you. This is an idea that is attempting to focus our ethics on a precisely and purely formal aspect. There's no content in that, so that if one conceivably, we're interested in doing something that somebody else considered nefarious, as long as you're willing to suffer the same thing that you're giving, there's no reason why you should not make it a general rule of conduct. It's an effort to trust reason to say that nobody in their right mind will do such a thing that is heinous. Nobody in their right mind will do such a thing that will be so offensive. And so it's trusting that human reason will itself rule out things which are, in fact, injurious, things that make social living impossible, things that frustrate our nature. But it doesn't in any way force us back onto an analysis of nature. It doesn't require any anthropology. It's an effort to say there's a way to be reasonable and a way, in fact, to accomplish our human purposes that doesn't require an analysis of our human nature. Any analysis of our human nature would be presenting a rule which were somehow goal-based and hence subject to the utilitarian calculation of values. Instead, this is an effort to say reason can ground ethics purely on its own terms. In the shortest possible compass, I may never make an exception for myself. What I command others to do, I must myself feel commanded to do. What I forbid others to do, I must also forbid to myself. As such, Kant thinks, and I think he has rightly achieved this, he has gotten a vision of ethics which is universal. It can apply to everybody. It's certainly objective in the sense that it can be articulated in so many words and discussed, and it's something which is intelligible. It's something that's able to be understood. Whether it has enough meat, whether it has enough substance, is a matter for great discussion. It does certainly achieve his own objective of focusing on freedom as the grounds for morality rather than focusing on nature or some natural end. Now, despite the great differences between this system of ethics and traditional natural law theory, as we have been describing it earlier in these lectures, I find it very interesting to note that as Kant is trying to explain his theory, as he's trying to give a philosophical justification for this categorical imperative and this ethics of duty rather than, say, an ethics of nature or an ethics of virtue, he does, however, still refer to any number of formulations that have a kind of a natural law subtle implication, that there's sort of a quiet advertence to it. And so, curiously and paradoxically, there's a way in which even Immanuel Kant can be thought of as part of the natural law tradition. In the original formulation of the categorical imperative, there's no hint of it. It's purely formal. Let me read it to you. Act in such a way that the maxim of your action can become a law for all mankind. That's merely suggesting that what you've got to do is be universal about it. If you command it to others, you're yourself under the command. If you want to permit it to yourself, everybody else must equally be permitted it. So it, for instance, tells us not to lie because we wouldn't want people lying to us. And it can apply to any particular example that we might come up with. But in his subsequent formulations of the categorical imperative, formulations which he urges are equivalent, are the same thing. He claims he's not introducing something new. I find that there is a subtle reference to that substantive tradition about human nature. Let me read you the formulation that occurs a little bit later in his text. So act as to treat all men not simply as a means, but always at the same time as ends in themselves. Now, this is to focus on ends and means. That is, it's to focus on what is something that's so important that it's a goal or a purpose or something that has an intrinsic dignity, and what, on the other hand, is something that's a means to that end, that which has a purely utility value. And it's a suggestion that while we can use lots of things, money, property, food, paintings, all sorts of things in this world, we may legitimately use them as means for our chosen ends. What this principle is suggesting is we may never use a human being as a mere means. We must always respect that human being as an end. It doesn't forbid us to use a human being as a means so long as we respect him as an end. And so, for example, if I have employees in a company of mine, admittedly, they are the means for making profit for my company. What this formulation forbids is that I merely treat them as slaves, merely take them as agents for the profitability of my company or myself or my particular party. That so long as I'm respecting them as human beings, as ends in themselves, I may also use them and collect their energies together as means toward our common end. But I never may treat them as merely means. As such, one is invoking now not a pure reason claim, but I think one is invoking a nature claim. Why is it that all human beings should be treated as ends and never mere means, where everything else in the universe may be treated as a mere means? This is, I think, subtly to be recognizing the intrinsic dignity of the human being as a separate kind. And hence, in a way, it invokes some of the very substance and basis and fundamental principle of the natural law without saying so. It manages to bring into the ethics that which we all agree on without forcing a fight about metaphysics and how much we're willing to grant about natures and natural ends. One then, I think, can try to form a balanced assessment of Immanuel Kant as someone who, in fact, supports and gives us a new way to think about natural law, even if it's not the whole and complete tradition of natural law, such as we found it in earlier thinkers. He does give us reason to think in terms of a common human nature, precisely in order to ask the questions of what reason we'll find reasonable. What is it that a human reason trying to think about ethics will find to be universal and intelligible and objective so as to promote the goal of as much freedom as possible, and especially to promote freedom in a way that enhances our human dignity rather than in some way detracts from it? Hence, he proposes something that is new and very interesting for the history of ethics. Now, in lectures to come, I will forego trying to tell the rest of the history of natural law, for as we enter the contemporary period, there are so many thinkers who contribute to it in a number of ways. And instead, for the remaining 8 lectures in this series, what I will try to do is appreciate contemporary dimensions of natural law, not by attempting a historical approach, but by taking a topical approach, looking at problems, because I think we'll find them very interesting.